This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Troy Swanson, sitting in for Steve Thomas. My guest today is Dr. Nicole Cook, MS-LIS Program Director and Associate Professor at the School of Information Sciences at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She is the author of the book Fake News and Alternative Facts, Information Literacy in a Post-Truth Era, published by the American Library Association.
With library budgets constantly shrinking, it's getting harder and harder to provide the resources your library patrons want and need. That's why our friends at Mometrics Test Preparation created the Mometrics e-Library. Through their e-Library portal, Mometrics offers study guides and practice questions for over 1,800 different exams covering college entrance, graduate school, nursing, medical, teacher certification, civil service, and many other careers and fields of study, all fully customizable and at a fraction of the cost of the printed books. It's like having an entire library of test prep materials all at your fingertips. So save space, save paper, and save money with Mometrics e-Library. To learn more, visit goelibrary.com. That's goelibrary.com.
Nicole, welcome to the show, and thank you for talking to me.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
I'm excited to have you. I wanted to talk to you as part of my ongoing series on fake news and libraries. Your book on fake news is definitely timely, unfortunately.
Right.
And it's very well done. And I'm particularly excited to talk to you about the connections with your information literacy background between information literacy, teaching, higher education, and fake news.
Mm-hmm.
To get us started, let me ask you just a general question about information literacy. I've had the privilege to read a chapter that you co-authored with Rachel M. McGee in the upcoming book, Meta-Literate Learning in the Post-Truth World, edited by Tom Mackey and Trudy Jacobson. You and your co-author write, and I'm quoting, "We need our students to be more than just information literate, media literate, and literate in other distinct areas. Aspiring information professionals need to be meta-literate, and they need to have a solid ability and willingness to impart this critical thinking lens and skill set to their own students and patrons." So I was wondering if you could talk about your perspectives on the relationship between these concepts, information literacy and meta-literacy, for librarians, and how they connect to the discussions on fake news and libraries.
Sure. So I think the background, especially of the chapter that I had the honor of co-writing with Dr. Rachel McGee, who also works here at Illinois, Dr. McGee works in media literacy, and she was a teen librarian, and that's, you know, her background is content production and things of that nature, whereas before I came to Illinois, I was an reference and instruction librarian for many years. So, you know, my background is information literacy. So when we came together and we started working, it was right at the beginning of this kind of fake news craze. It was shortly after the 2016 election. And just like everyone else, we were, you know, getting these questions about, you know, fake news. Oh my God, what are we going to do? And so along with a couple other colleagues here, we put on a workshop in February of 2017. And it was just meant to be, you know, have a group of students, staff, faculty, you know, this is the problem. This is how we see it. And how can we work together, not only to, you know, work with our own perhaps anxiety, but how do we work with our students and community members? And that workshop ended up attracting over 100 people in person and online. And we actually had a lot of community members. So it was a really good workshop. And we were able to really figure some things out. So one of the things that came out of this particular workshop is that we had students here at the graduate school that came to the workshop and said, okay, I don't know what to do. Like if I go into an academic library or even if I go into a public library and I'm asked these questions by our patrons, I don't know how to answer them. I don't know how to direct them. And what was a little perplexing to me was some of these students I know took our information literacy instruction course.
Mm-hmm.
And so my response to them was, of course you know how to do it. We've covered this, right? We talked about this. And I think what was happening was it's not that they're unconfident mm-hmm. in their information literacy skills. I think they were looking at them in a silo. and they weren't readily looking at it as I have this great skill set that I can now apply to this fake news phenomenon. So I don't think they really realize that, you know, that these are transferable skills. So between that and this idea that, you know, my colleague teaches media literacy, I have other colleagues that specialize in visual literacy and all of these things. I think this is where meta literacy comes in, and we're looking at it in the chapter and in our practice here in the classroom as meta literacy is kind of an umbrella term for literacy, critical thinking, being skeptical, being strategic with this essentially overload of information that we have, and how do we look at things and incorporate all of the different dimensions. So if we're looking at examples, you know, don't just apply your quote unquote information literacy skills. Don't just apply your quote unquote media literacy skills, but looking at skills in their entirety, holistically, and how do we apply all of these different skills that relate to literacy? How do we then apply it to fake news? And so when we give them examples in different classes and workshops, we make sure that we have a variety of examples. We have print examples. We have photographs that, you know, may have been photoshopped or altered. We have other examples of videos that may have been manipulated in some way. So how are we looking at this across the board and not just looking at how do I teach these skills in this particular setting? So looking at meta literacy as just a much more broad, encompassing look at literacy.
As you're describing the project and think about meta literacy, but at some point it's like, how does that person take in information, connect it with themselves, and either confirm, make something new, see the world in a different way? And I think that's sort of the thing that I really appreciate about meta literacy is it tries to get us to step back and make these connections. Cause in some ways there's some differences, there's some nuance to what we do and some value in those different kinds of literacies, but also they're not that different.
Right. And I think to your point, they're not that different and they shouldn't be siloed as, you know, not having those interactions and those overlaps and those, you know, they complement one another.
So let's shift a little bit to fake news and importantly, the book that you've written on fake news from ALA. I wonder if you could discuss the impact of the affective or emotional dimensions. This is the thing that interests me. That kind of part of the psyche, we often focus on the cognitive side, that quote-unquote information knowledge side. So what ways do we overlook the affective aspects of learning?
Sure. So my academic training is in information behavior. And so, you know, in a nutshell, I usually say, you know, information behavior is how is a study of how people seek, use, and avoid information. And just like you said, a lot of the emphasis when you do information behavior research or study is about the cognitive. How do we actually process that information? And so it really gets down sometimes to just data. And, you know, there are people doing studies with eye trackers, and they're really looking at the mechanics of absorbing and using information. So the affective domain is really talking about the emotional or, you know, how do we add context to this data? And so, again, you know, just as I mentioned with meta literacy, kind of looking at this process in a more holistic way. And also in the same vein, how do we look at people or learners in a more holistic way? So, you know, for example, in information literacy or even in fake news, if we're trying to help people navigate these landscapes, we can give them all the data and the strategies and the tips and the techniques, and they may not be able to apply them. They may not want to apply them. You know, just as a quick example, I've done webinars and other workshops where I know that I can't use political examples, because people have an emotional reaction to this politician or that politician, and it doesn't matter what quality techniques and strategies I'm giving them, they don't like that person. And because I use that example, they're just going to disregard everything I said.
Right. Yeah.
So this is what's coming down to this affective dimension. And, you know, I do want to put out there that by the affective domain, I mean this very broadly. So we're not, we are talking about, you know, information that might make you angry or sad or some of, you know, the bigger, easier to name emotions. So we're not just talking about those, but we're talking about this very wide spectrum of emotion. I mean, there could be something that just makes me uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Like I may not even be able to actually put my finger on it and say to you, Troy, you're making me uncomfortable. It's just kind of that, you know, innate, I don't feel right about this. I don't like it. Right. So therefore, I'm going to disregard everything you say.
It's like just hovering in the background.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so, and I mean, on the other end of that, when we're talking about emotional reactions to information, there are things that could make us, you know, happy and excited and, you know, have, let's go on the positive end of the emotions. And that's the information that I gravitate to. That's the information that I'll seek out. That's the information that will stay with me because it makes me feel good. And it, that type of information that elicits really positive response, that's the information that tends to already confirm what we think we know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. So we have that negative reaction because you're challenging me and you're making me upset, you know. But the other information that's really positive, yeah, I like that because that's what I already think.
Right. Yeah. I liked when you mentioned your definition of information behavior that you included avoidance. Right.
Yes, because, absolutely.
Because there's, I mean, you just were kind of hitting on the confirmation bias, but also mm-hmm. I think people yeah. actively work to avoid information. Even if they hear it,
yeah.
they just won't deal with it, right? They'll put it away.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, there are, it's called monitoring and blunting, right? I could give you theories for days, right? but that, you know, if I'm particularly interested in a topic or a current event, I can monitor that, topic and I can, you know, watch news for 8 hours straight and I can look it up on the internet. I can get a paper and all of these things because I'm monitoring that information. And then I might get to a point where I want to blunt it. And then move into information avoidance because for whatever reason, maybe you've hit your saturation point or maybe you just decided, I don't want to know anymore. And then you start that information avoidance. And I mean, we deal with information avoidance every day just because of the sheer amount of information we're presented with at any given time. And so it's part of that essentially a coping strategy,
yeah.
right? I mean, we make decisions all day, every day and aren't even cognizant of them. And we absorb certain pieces of information and we, you know, jettison other pieces just because it's not part of our framework. So it could, there could be deliberate avoidance. It could also just be the unconscious avoidance that we do every day.
Right. And there's no way around, I think, that you have to use that framework, you said, you know, to decide what's important. So you're having all this stuff come at you.
Right.
What's important, what's not.
Right.
And so sometimes it's accidental avoidance, like you said.
Oh, sure.
But then
absolutely.
I think we've hit a point where clearly there's some purposeful avoidance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, and I think, you know, kind of circling back to your question, when we're talking about, you know, instruction and how do we do that? Some of it is a little bit of a crapshoot, right? I mean, especially, you know, I've done one shots, you've done one shot information literacy sessions, instruction sessions. And you just don't know what examples are going to land, what examples are not going to land. You know, we've all had students that said, you know, oh, my God, that makes perfect sense, right? Because that landed with them in some way. They reacted positively. And then we always have the ones that perhaps, you know, something landed negatively. Mm-hmm. And then there's the whole other dimension that's even outside of fake news, misinformation, and disinformation is this idea of relevance. Right. If what you're saying is not really relevant to them, they may, you know, the students may not take the information because it doesn't have any type of immediacy or they don't need to deal with that assignment right now. So they don't necessarily have to, you know, pay attention to everything you say right this moment.
Right. And we've all dealt with that.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Right. In your book, you mentioned the idea of production of confusion as a tactic utilized by politicians. Specifically noting some of the work of the Trump administration. Can you talk a little bit about what that means, production of confusion?
Sure. So, you know, I think a lot of us might know that by, you know, a colloquial phrase as, you know, quote unquote, dazzling them with the BS, right? And there's just so much information being purposely, you know, thrown at us, and information that has a spin or a particular bias or a particular leaning, or, you know, things that have dog whistles underneath them, that information, you know, that really, that type of verbiage that really relies on stereotypes and things of that nature that's designed to elicit particular responses from people. So we have all of this information that's being manipulated in some way, and essentially it's being used to distract, confuse, distract, to kind of say, look, there's that shiny object over there and you should pay attention to that. And then while you're over there paying attention to that, we're going to be over here, you know, pushing through bills and, you know, dismantling something that means a lot to you, and you won't even know that it happened because you were otherwise occupied. So it's a technique essentially to keep us from paying attention to the things that might actually be important. And so this production of confusion, I think, is a great name for it, and that's certainly what the journalists and the broadcasters, this is how they've referred to it. And this idea of just kind of, you know, diverting attention so people don't actually see the things that are happening every day. And the production of confusion, that information that comes out with that, that's the information that's usually gossipy or salacious or scandalous, or, you know, and that's that kind of information that makes a transition from, you know, the 24-hour cable stations up through, you know, the tabloid TV shows, the gossip shows, you know, and right up into the National Enquirer. So this kind of information tends to have a decent shelf life and really has that ability to kind of move from platform to platform, whereas some of the other more quote-unquote factual information or even maybe boring information, you know, changes in bills and legislation, that doesn't have as much of a shelf life and doesn't move in between platforms as much as the other type of information does. So it's really just a way to distract.
Yeah, and you kind of hit on this, but it seems to have a new kind of poignancy as in our kind of information infrastructure, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's the shareable nature of it kind of keeps it alive.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's that production of confusion, I think, is made more problematic. And by problematic, it does have problems associated with it, but I also mean it's harder to get a handle on, it's harder to control, it's harder to address this type of information, because this is the information that runs through Facebook, runs through Twitter, mm-hmm. runs through the different social media platforms, and you know, half the time you can't even catch it. You see the clickbait articles, and next thing you know, somebody shared it, and it's got, you know, a couple thousand retweets, it's got a couple thousand shares, and it's gone quote-unquote viral. And we're dealing with all of this information on just really a new level. Mm-hmm. And it's distracting, right, because we're interested in it, and we want to know how it ends.
Right. Right. And it's, and you know, your point about like why we don't pay attention to the bills, it's so much more dramatic and engaging
yes.
in some ways, right? Than the kind of monotony and the bureaucracy of legislation.
Yeah, absolutely. So. Absolutely. And I think again, it goes back to the affective or emotional domain of information seeking and absorption and use. You know, this salacious information is just more interesting. Right. And it may not offend us in any way. Whereas if, you know, I know people that actually watch C-SPAN like they watch soap operas, which it amazes me. Right. But, you know, that's the information that people perhaps perceive as boring or, you know, not worth my time. Again, that's that reaction. I don't want to be bored. I don't want to be angry, right? Because if you watch some of those hearings, there's a possibility you might get upset about something. And I'm going to stay over here with like Inside Edition and National Enquirer mm-hmm. because that's fun, mm-hmm. right? You know, we sometimes call that infotainment, you know, information that is just entertaining. And that's what I go to when I'm bored or don't have anything else to do.
Yeah. Yeah. A couple of topics I want to pull out of your book that I think connect. You talk about political economy and the illusion of choice. Can you define those for us and kind of talk about how they're related?
Sure. So political economy, we're borrowing that, if you will, from media and cultural studies. And it really is talking about the production of information in media for profit. And so that's where we get the economy part of it. And so a lot of what we've been seeing lately is, you know, we have so many more content producers now. We have folks that are running blogs, running social media pages and groups, and just writing for local entities and things of that nature. So it used to be that we had very limited choice, mm-hmm. right? And so then we come into this illusion, this illusion of choice. We used to have very few options. Like, you know, you had CBS, NBC, and ABC, and maybe PBS, right? And now we have hundreds of channels, hundreds of networks. We have any number of social media platforms, and anyone is able to produce information and content on certain of these platforms. And so, you know, this illusion of choice, oh, if I don't like this channel, I can go over here and pick another channel. If I don't like this Facebook group, I can go over here to Twitter. So while choice is good, I think people are making the false connection between choice and quality. And just because you have hundreds of things to choose from, it doesn't mean that all of them are quality or worth your time and consideration. And so I think, you know, in some way it goes back to this information overload. I have so many choices. I'm just going to pick one, right? But kind of circling back to the political economy, you know, when the fake news really started coming out, there were reports and articles about fake news farms where people, you know, this is their job to produce these stories, to produce this blog content, because every time you click or view, you're producing income for these content creators. And so, you know, they hide behind the idea that it's satire, or it was just a joke, or it was just this, or it was just that, and not taking the responsibility for the misinformation and disinformation that they're spreading. It doesn't matter because, you know, they're making money. There's a really interesting book called The Greatest Lie I Ever Told, and it's by Ryan Holiday. And he has a really fascinating chapter on how political economy works in the blogosphere. And so, you know, there's, you know, different tiers of blogs and different types of information that's being produced. And it's all part of this cycle to produce income and to generate clicks. And again, by the time you figure it out, it's too late now. You've already given them the click. And you've already shared it and gotten them 200 more clicks. You know, and it goes back to, again, the production, the content production. You know, you could have a second tier blog that is peripherally related to a mainstream entity that you may know and trust. And because you see that it has some type of relationship, you kind of sometimes automatically turn over that trust, not realizing that this is not really an arm of this major publication or media outlet. It just kind of has this peripheral relationship. But sometimes, you know, people just don't go that far. They just see, oh, it's related to CBS, so I can read it. Right. But it's this whole production cycle and how things then get picked up. So if I can get my false information into this outlet, somebody's going to pick it up, and then it's going to go a step higher. Then it'll go a step higher, and then it becomes, you know, out of our control. Mm-hmm. So political economy, how people are actually making money off of misinformation and disinformation.
It seems like really problematic when the income model is separated from any ideas of quality. And, you know, the pre-cable news media environment definitely had its problems, and it, you know, like limited gatekeepers of who got to play ball.
Right.
But, you know, the reputation and journalistic kind of approach, at least, was sort of important to them because that's how they attracted people. And then it maybe that lessened a little bit as we moved into the cable news era, but that still existed at some level. But it seems we've hit the point where, you know, throw the cards in the air.
Exactly.
Get those clicks. It doesn't matter. I can say whatever I want. As long as you click, I'm getting what I need. And there is no connection to that quality.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's not to say there's not quality journalism, obviously.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, I mentioned cognitive authority a little earlier, and because there are so many content producers, you know, you don't necessarily know who to trust. You don't necessarily know who to believe. So, you know, to your point about throwing the cards in the air, I no longer know which card to pick up now because there are so many cards, and some of them may be quality information, some of them may not be, but since they're all kind of piled up together, it's hard to really discern. And I think that's where our work is still really important, to help people have strategies and have a mindset where they can say, there are a lot of cards here and they're not all equal. How do I go about making some determination about which of these cards is quality and which of these cards should I, you know, disregard?
Right. To get back to information literacy, do you think that the information literacy framework from ACRL sets a useful context for teaching students about fake news and misinformation?
Oh, for sure. For sure. And I was just reviewing the framework. Obviously I've dealt with the framework and its iterations as a professional and also as an instructor. I think sometimes a lot of this goes back to what audience you're dealing with. I can do things in my classroom, with aspiring library professionals that may not be appropriate in a public library that's having a fake news workshop, right? But I think the basic tenets really are important. In particular, this idea of looking at information in context and really considering, you know, how it's created. The information creation, I think, is something, you know, that I pay a lot of attention to. And also the kind of the sharing of information, right? So if I trust you implicitly as a source, if I actually knew what your sources were, I may not trust all of your sources, right? So this is this multi-dimensional piece of what information you trust, what sources you trust, because it's sometimes almost like playing telephone. You could tell me something and I believe you because I trust you, mm-hmm. right? But maybe you didn't get it from the best source. So it's even more than, you know, just taking information at face value. So I think, you know, using the framework to really drive home some of the finer points and really look at information in a more contextual way, you know, again, not just data, but what is the context that really informs that data and informs how we use that data and how useful that data can be. I think I use the framework all the time, and I think we can emphasize certain points depending on, you know, who we're dealing with and what content. But they can certainly be used, in their entirety to really give us a lens through which to use and view and evaluate information. So, you know, maybe you've encountered this. A lot of times outside of our profession, folks don't pick up on information literacy, but they'll pick up on critical thinking or, you know, the need to evaluate information or the need to be savvier information consumers. But I think the framework underlies all of that, and it allows us to do certain work within our profession and in our classrooms, and it allows us to go out into the public and really, you know, let the public know we actually can help you with your fake news problem, and allow us to address on a different platform.
So can you tell us what's the exciting things going on at the library school at U of I?
Yeah. So a couple things happening in the fall that I'm excited about. In the fall, I'll teach an information behavior class. We call it Use and Users here, but it is information behavior class. And the last couple of times I've run the class, we've had really the theme of fake news. And so while we talk about the basics and we talk about theory, and we talk about information literacy, we then apply it to fake news. So I'm always excited to have students think about information behavior in different ways. You know, like I said earlier, sometimes the tendency is to view things in isolation or in these silos. And it's really interesting to see folks make the connections between information literacy, information behavior, fake news, and how it's all, you know, part of that larger pot. Research-wise, I will be co-leading what they call a research cluster here at the university, and it's all about fake news. We're actually trying to move away from fake news as a phrase because it has so many, you know, pop culture implications now, but really focus a little bit more on misinformation and disinformation, which of course is what underlies this whole fake news problem. And it's going to be based here at the School of Information Sciences, but I'm co-leading it with a colleague in the journalism school. And hopefully we'll be talking with some colleagues in the psychology department. I've been doing some work with the psychology department because while they don't deal with fake news in the same way that we do, they've done decades worth of work in what they call decision science. And decision science is information behavior, right? How do you use all of this information to actually make decisions? And we're going to try and get some folks from sociology and just some of the other disciplines, because I think a lot of people are dealing with misinformation and disinformation and trying to figure out how to work with their own constituents and in their own research and teaching. And we're not having a joint conversation. And they may be using different terminology than we're using. So hopefully this research cluster will enable us to pull some things together and have a larger, more productive conversation.
That's fantastic. It is a moment for interdisciplinary conversation.
I think so. Yeah, absolutely.
And what a great opportunity for library schools to kind of lead the way. So that's something that all of us will have to keep an eye on.
Absolutely.
Well, Nicole, I want to thank you very much for your time. This has been a lot of fun. I hope that listeners will look for your book from ALA, Fake News and Alternative Facts. If listeners wanted to learn more about your work, how can they do that?
Sure. They can go to my website, which is www.nicolecook.info. And that has the book and some other articles related to fake news and information literacy.
And that's Cook, C-O-O-K-E, right?
With a D. Yes, so absolutely. Thank you.
That. Yes. So, okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta. Views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of my place of work or the place of work of guests. For past interviews, visit circulatingideas.com and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Overcast, or your podcast app of choice. And help others find the show by leaving a rating or review. You can follow the show on Twitter at @CircIdeas or like the show's Facebook page. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening and keep circulating your ideas. Save space, save paper, and save money with Mometrics eLibrary. To learn more, visit goelibrary.com. That's goelibrary.com.